Today we have Bill Hamm on the show to discuss creative financing in real estate. He is a 15-year veteran real estate investor, an educator, and an author of a new book called Creative Cash. Bill understands real estate cycles, and he offers up tools such as seller financing and master lease options to help other real estate investors become more creative and increase the probability of closing more deals. Before we jump into the intro, we recently launched a YouTube channel. Some people love podcasts and some people love videos. If you have interest in videos, check us out and subscribe on YouTube. Just look up Darren Batchelder in the search field or click the YouTube link on either the DarrenBatchelder.com website or on my Instagram bio. Now, on to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing, be introduced to the players that are getting it done, and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Bill Hamm before we start the show. Bill lives in Georgia and has been focused on real estate for over 15 years. Bill helped Jake and Gino establish their education platform, and he is the main coach in that program. Bill just released a book called Creative Cash, which outlines his experience in using various strategies to get real estate deals done. He is a problem solver, and he loves to give back and teach others. Now, on to the show. Hello, everyone. Today, we've got a special guest with us today. We've got Bill Hamm. Bill, appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So the way I know Bill is actually, he was a referral. So I had Jake and Gino both on the podcast at separate times. Jake was on episode 17 and Gino episode 22. And, you know, Gino reached out and said, hey, you should have Bill on the show. And so we got in touch with each other and he's just coming out with a book. So the timing was fantastic. And I think that this is going to be a great conversation. So I'm looking forward to spending a little time with Bill here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So just to start out with, how many properties, how many units have you been involved with on the real estate side?
Yeah, on the somewhat ownership side, I'll say the portfolio I created, a little over about 1,100 units or so. I have been involved awesome. With thousands through management, through consulting, through teaching, in partnerships with other people. So a long career. Been doing this about a little over 15 years now.
15 years. That's fantastic. So I'm novice. I'm 3 years in here. So I'm looking forward to learning a lot from you, my friend.
Yeah, I got some good stuff.
So in terms of your role, I know that at one point, I don't know if you still are, but you were a coach within Jake and Gino's group. Are you still a coach?
I am their head coach. I actually helped them establish their coaching program.
Oh, is that right? So, okay. So
right. I helped them go from being just a podcast or not just a podcast, but I helped them going from being a podcast basically only into developing an actual education program.
Very, very cool. So you helped them develop the whole program.
Correct.
And then how many coaches you have kind of underneath you?
Four or five right now. Yeah, five.
Fantastic. Well, you know, they, you know, in terms of books, when I got started 3 years ago, their book was one of the first books I read. And, you know, they have a very successful podcast. But now with what you've helped them build through the coaching program, and now they're doing conferences. I mean, they've got the whole suite going to not only grow the portfolio, but also to help other people do it as well.
Correct.
So that's awesome. So you've got this new book out called Creative Cash. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Creative Cash is a book about My first 402 unit portfolio. So my first 402 units, I was able to establish without using traditional lenders, such as a bank or agency debt. So I used lease options. I used seller financing, credit cards, you know, all different types of creative financing techniques in order to build my first portfolio. Reason being, I was new to the business, had no experience, had no credibility, had no money. So I really had no choice. I had to just get out and figure out how not to starve in the world of real estate. And so that made me, it made me learn the art of problem solving. And so that really is what the book of Creative Cash is about. It's about getting results in real estate by using problem solving techniques to create value that you may otherwise not have. So, you know, I realize this, if you don't have a lot of cash, that's not, that doesn't stop you from being in this business. It is a hurdle. It does mean you have some other obstacles to overcome, but if you're not rich, you can get into real estate. You just have to do it with value, and you have to bring value to sellers. What kind of value? Problem solving value. And that's what this book is about, is to show you how to solve problems. In exchange, get access to real estate.
Fantastic. So what year was that when you started getting involved?
05. I started in 2005.
So 2005 was still a good real estate market. So
it was.
It's interesting because I read the book, and there's a lot of things that I learned from the book. And I kind of thought that some of those creative financing strategies really come to play when the banks and everybody's kind of go away and they don't want to finance anymore. They're totally focused on all their, you know, their workout issues and they're scared to make any new loans. So, but 2005, 2006 was still, you know, a good time. So I'm kind of surprised. I would have thought you would have said 2007, 2008, 2009.
I got going heavily into multifamily closer into the 8, 9, 10 range. My first 75 units or so were actually houses.
Okay.
So I was, the national market was good from 05 to 08. And of course, everywhere was sort of bad after 08. I'm from Macon, Georgia. And middle Georgia area has always been somewhat of a economically distressed area, not the most affluent area. So I think people in that particular city always had problems and always had some issues. And let me be clear, you know, my first handful of units were pretty tough real estate. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I was a slumlord for a little while, you know, and I'll tell you, slumlording is an art, you know, and I really got dirty in the ditches out there on the street learning real estate. Those were the sellers that had problems. I don't necessarily recommend listeners get in that type of product. It was really good for an education. It was really good on the tuition side. Not great on the money side. Right. So it was really good for me to establish a business. And then what I realized was to take those techniques and start applying them to multifamily. I really got the multifamily going good around 08 through 2012 or so. But yeah, to your point, we see this these techniques much more readily available in cycles. So right. Real estate and the economy always moves through market cycles. Over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the market's been really good. Therefore, there has not been a lot of creative financing. So this is not a subject you're going to find a lot of material on. There's not a lot of works out there on this. Well, that's because over the last 5, 7, 8 years, sellers, if they had a problem, they would just take the property, put it on the market, sell it. They'd probably get their asking price plus a dollar, you know. And so When the markets turn, and that's when creative financing becomes much more viable, which is why I've brought the book out today, is because I think this is going to be, well, I know from experience in market cycles, these are going to be the techniques that we really use to get deals done that may be slightly less than perfect. You know, if an asset has some distress to it, maybe there's repairs and maintenance. Maybe the tenants have gotten delinquent on rent, such as COVID at the moment. These are all areas that are going to make that property questionable on financing, or at least questionable for the top tier financing. I mean, can you get a hard money loan or some kind of bridge loan? Yes, of course. But when you go into Fannie or Freddie, these kind of lenders, they really want top tier products. And at the moment, we're seeing Freddie specifically and Fannie start to really look at resume. So it is getting more difficult for people that are new to the business and don't have a 3-year resume. And that's what Freddie is asking for right now, a 3-year resume in multifamily to qualify for one of their loans. So it doesn't really matter now how much money you have or how much net worth you have to Freddie Mac if you don't have a 3-year resume in a like kind asset. You know, so you can't go do a 10 unit and then expect to do 100 units. Right. You already have to have sort of like kind experience. And that's really going to be tough for people wanting to get into the business. And that's why I'm saying that this creative techniques going forward are going to be very valuable in a down cycle. And it's because the lenders quit lending, as we see.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I was excited about this conversation because, you know, sometimes there's people in the upmarket too that come to me and say, hey, look, I'm willing to hustle, but I don't have the money. And, you know, in today's market, because the agencies have been so active, you know, and the bank lenders have been so active that, you know, you could solve that problem by partnering with other experienced people. So you go out and you do the hustle, you find the deal, you underwrite the deal, you kind of get it to the point where it's almost locked up. And then you bring an experienced guy on, and that's, you know, has been, you know, my advice to kind of the younger generation that, you know, they're hungry, but they just don't have the capital yet. They don't have the experience yet. But what's interesting to me is I don't know if it's 2 months from now or 6 months from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now. But at some point, like you said, it's economic cycles and we're going to go into a downturn. And I saw it happen where, you know, in the Great Recession, for sure, all the lenders just completely stopped lending. And so you can choose at that point, do I just get out of the game or do I figure out another way? And I think that some of the options that you're talking about in your book is, hey, let's think of another way to get this done where it works for both the seller and the buyer. And yeah. So that's attractive to me. You know, another, you know, tool in the toolbox. And some people don't really think of it that way because why do I need to learn this now when, you know, we're still a good lending environment, but it could change on a dime.
And it will. And so I can give you two major points to watch. Number one, we always watch our lenders because the way this works is as the world changes and lenders get nervous, they start to put less money into the market. As they put less money into the market or they raise the criteria, and I don't necessarily mean interest rates. So we're not talking interest rates. Interest rates are low. That may not stay forever. But right now, it's not an interest rate conversation. It's a qualification for the loan conversation. And so we're seeing lenders start to lower loan to value, ask for more resume. Loan to value, resume is a biggie, and then quality of product. That's the third one I was thinking of that they're really moving towards. So you watch your lenders to see what's going on. Now, at the moment, people would say, gosh, they really like multifamily and lenders are aggressive about multifamily. That's actually the problem. It's a supply and demand problem. So number one, on multifamily real estate, the supply is low and the demand is huge, which is allowing Fannie and Freddie to put a more expensive product out there because it has not stopped the borrowing for multifamily. So that is one negative that if the trade volume continues at the rate that it has, Fannie and Freddie won't pull back some of those criteria. What we're seeing right now is the 12 to 18 month PITI reserves, the principal interest tax and insurance reserves, that you're having to put up to qualify for a Fannie and Freddie loan. And someone asked me the other day, they said, when do you think Fannie and Freddie will stop with these reserves? And I said, when we stop borrowing so much money from them. if they can do these loans and we're still showing up to the door and accepting these mortgages with those terms and it's in their favor, why would they quit?
Right.
They won't. It has nothing to do with COVID. That's what they're saying. But if we keep borrowing at the rate we're borrowing, they're incentivized to keep the prices high. It's supply and demand. That's one issue that's going to make Fannie and Freddie much, much more difficult to deal with going forward. Number one. Number two, hotels, strip malls, and regular malls are going into in offices are starting to go into foreclosure at a quick clip. All right. We know the regular traditional mall space is sort of a dinosaur. It is a dying model. There have been several in Atlanta, and I watched the news. There's been a lot of malls around the country that have gone back into foreclosure. We're starting to see hotels now go into foreclosure because the hospitality industry has not recovered. And I'm afraid if people continue working from home, the office space may follow. So, yes, there's a high trade volume and a lot of interest in multifamily. But at the same time, that same lender, remember, they lent on other asset classes, not Fannie and Freddie necessarily, but CMBS, local banks, other debt right. products have lent on these other asset classes that are now starting to collapse. And most lenders are going to kind of say, hey, if we're losing on this product here, why would we be so quick to put more debt into a market that we're already losing assets in? And so that's a big indication. So your foreclosures and hospitality, office, and retail specifically are going to pull a lot of lending liquidity out of the market, as well as high trade volume in multifamily. Both are going to lend towards these lenders tightening criteria, which is why when you have an asset that's not top performing property, you're going to struggle to get loans for that because they're not going to need to do subpar products. Or subpar lenders, you know, right. And that's where creative financing is going to come into play.
That makes a lot of sense. So have you done any of those other asset classes or single family, multifamily?
That's where I've been my entire career. I have not done strip malls, retail or hospitality. I know it academically. I study it as part of my business. I keep an eye on the other food groups right. So that I know what's going on. But no, I have not personally owned any.
I don't know many people that play in that space, but I'm just curious as to whether, you know, there's going to be some good deals and maybe, you know, it's a time for people to look in those areas, but I don't know anything about it. So I can't.
I think there will be good deals when we finally hit the bottom. Right now, you're going to have an issue of what we call catching the falling knife.
Right.
You know, where is the bottom and have we hit the bottom? And so if you kind of jump in on one of these distressed assets a little too soon, you may have a hard decline in that value before a recovery. And that can be true in certain markets as well. Say like New York at the moment, you know, they're really struggling with their property value and their occupancy. And the decline is still current. So it hasn't leveled off at a bottom or a base yet. So you would need to be careful about those assets. Although I think New York is technically a great market and has been historically in America one of the strongest markets,
right. It
will recover, not tomorrow, but eventually, and I'm guessing within the next 10 years or so, that market will recover. But it doesn't mean you really need to go in there and buy assets today. Give that a minute. So we want to be careful about catching that falling knife.
Right. So let's stick with multifamily then, since that's both of our kind of the playground we play in. Talk about, you know, in the book, it talks a lot about distressed assets, and that can include the property is distressed, and it can also include the property is fine, but the seller has distress.
Talk about
those two components.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what I have come to realize in my career, especially in teaching and doing the business, is that a good deal is about 90% seller, 10% real estate. You can have a great deal or a bad deal or whatever kind of piece of real estate you want. If you don't have a willing seller, you don't have anything. And so I would really say that the real key to this business is focusing on the human aspect, not the sticks, the bricks, and the mud. So we want to go out and find sellers that have problems. Now, if a seller owns a building that is a distressed building, well, you probably have a distressed seller. But you could also have a distressed seller where the real estate is actually fine. It's something personal. Maybe they have health issues. Maybe they're just burned out. I love a good old-fashioned burned out landlord. You know, somebody who just thought they were smarter than the average bear. They were going to show us all how it was done. They jumped in there. They bought some real estate and they realized, hey, this is real. This is an actual tangible object. This is not a stock or a bond or some kind of, you know, just write a check and set it and forget it. It's not a rotisserie chicken, right? You got to manage these things. And I see a lot of really good, smart people that just made mistakes in purchasing and now kind of have buyer's remorse. Those are going to be the people that you really want to focus on. A second group would be ones that have debt coming due soon. That's a big one. If you have, what I would recommend to any listener out there, if you're looking to reach out and sort of contact sellers directly, not really going through a realtor, but you're going direct to seller, look for sellers who have loans that are coming due within the next 18 months, sometime between tomorrow and 18 months from now. Those are going to be very sensitive sellers. If the debt market pulls back, like I know it will, those people are going to have trouble refinancing. A lot of people over the last couple of years have bought under the BRRRR model, the buy, renovate, refi, and repeat. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that business model until there is.
Right.
And the catch is when the debt pulls back, it's the refi part, the buy and renovate and repeat, fine. It's the refinance that's the killer. And right now, a lot of lenders are not allowing cash out refinance. And that's what a lot of people bought these assets for, because they saw over the last 5 years, people buying an asset, holding on to it for 12 months, 18 months, refinancing, pulling out all of their down payment, maybe even plus some money. They've got no money in the deal. Returns are infinite, you know, and those are sort of the high flying deals. And people hear these stories and they think, oh, we can all go do that. That's not really true. That's a little more difficult to pull off than people sort of would like you to believe, especially someone selling you something. And so it's that refinance aspect. And I think that, you know, the people that had that as an exit strategy are going to find themselves motivated sellers over the next 18 months. And so that's why one of my target areas is trying to track data on debt and whose debts are coming due. That's where you want to be looking for deals.
So, you know, in the big multifamily space, which I would kind of define as 60 units or greater, predominantly the syndicators that I know work through brokers. That's where, you know, predominantly they're, whether it's off-market deals or fully marketed deals, that predominantly that type of product is coming through brokers. When you were talking about, you know, checking out the debt coming due and talking with sellers directly, are you referring to smaller multifamily, like,
correct,
you know, 4 units, 2 units, 8 units, 12 units? And because I still would think that the larger ones are going to use broker relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always sort of make the joke, do you ever see a 200 unit apartment complex with a for sale by owner sign, like scribbled right on a piece of cardboard out by the road? No, you don't find 200 units on Craigslist, right? That's right. Not where those assets are sold. So Darren, you're absolutely spot on. What I tell people is that from sort of 0 to 50, you are actually better off attempting to go through a direct contact campaign. That's, you know, back when I did direct contact, it was more like a little yellow postcard that said, we buy houses or we buy apartments.
Right.
Nowadays, obviously, we're a lot more technologically savvy than that. But, you know, text, email, things of that nature is a direct contact campaign. I think that's very effective, up to about 50 units. 50 units and higher, you're largely in the commercial realty space. And so it really depends on what asset class you're looking at. The larger ones definitely are typically sold through realtors. And that is a different business. That's a little bit more difficult. You've got a gatekeeper in there. I completely cover that in my book and how to work with realtors and creative financing. I love getting my deals from realtors, and almost all of my creative financing has actually come and had realtors involved with it. Little bit of an art to that, but yeah, you're absolutely right. 50 and under, straight to the owner. 50 and above, probably a realtor.
Fantastic. So, well, talk about that then. You know, you talk about it in your book. You just mentioned it. When you're dealing with the larger transactions, and you're going to do, we'll get into the details on some of the different strategies you've got. But sure, you pick one, and you're going to go down that path. You know, maybe the broker isn't familiar with how that works, or hasn't done one of those transactions before, and they're a little suspect, and they also, brokers like to get paid, right? They want to get their commission. So, you know, that brings in another variable. How do you, you know, handle that when you've got a seller, a broker who's worried about getting paid? How do you approach that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Because you're absolutely right. Can't be mad at a realtor for wanting to make a commission. That's what they're there for. So step one is really to analyze the deal, figure out what is right, wrong with the asset, and then try and figure out where the seller is at. So if you find that an asset won't qualify for traditional financing, just for example, let's say the debt service ratio is too low and the bank says, we don't want to do the deal. All right. The seller has a problem. Now, whether the seller knows they have a problem or not, that's another question. And that's what you have to figure out. You need to go now educate the realtor and possibly the seller that this deal isn't going to go for traditional financing and that that's not your problem. That's all buyers' problems. And that's a very important distinction. You don't want a realtor or a seller thinking that you're making some kind of creative offer because you have no money or no ability to close. That will get you not a good answer very quickly.
Sure. Right?
So step one is to let this realtor know, hey, you can buy the property. You know, you're good. It's not you. It's the asset that's the issue. And because the asset's the issue, the seller has an issue. So you sit down with the realtor and you say, I'd like to start off, point these things out and say, hey, you know, the property does this, this, and this, and that won't qualify. What do you suggest? And stop. And just see what that realtor says. You know, just it's the old, he who speaks first routine. So I always just ask, what do you think? And it's a genuine question. What should I do? I want to help. I want to close. I want you to get paid. I want me to get paid. What should we do here? And if the realtor doesn't have a great answer, that's when you say, well, would your seller be possibly interested in? That's where the creative offer comes in. And so you really want to be ready to explain and educate the realtor and seller on how that lease option or how that seller financing structure or debt partner or whatever structure you're going to use is going to work. So you really need to read my book. You really need to be able to understand and speak about the mechanics of how that deal works, because a confused mind says no.
Right.
If you really can explain what's going on and not only explain how it works, but explain two other things. One, why this is value for the seller. And number two, how that realtor is going to get a commission check out of this. So right. There's your big, yeah.
I love that approach. Like, what do you suggest? What do you think? Because now all of a sudden it gets the broker engaged where,
correct.
You know, he does want to get paid or she does want to get paid. And so she's thinking about it and she's like, yeah, you know, he's right. You know, it's not going to qualify, not just for him, but for everybody. And then it also helps them almost feel like they're coming up with the solution.
Buy-in.
Yeah.
That's what we're discussing, buy-in. And so that's why I am trying to, it's what I call the Columbo technique. If anybody remembers Peter Falk's character, Columbo, the old detective, he always kind of acted stupid, you know, but he really wasn't. He just kind of came off dumb. And so I do that in a sense with realtors and say things, gosh, you know, I like the deal. I really want to close. I like you. It's just, I'm not sure how to get the deal done, you know. And then I may make a suggestion about some sort of creative offer. And what I'm doing is I'm getting that realtor's buy-in. If they will help me create that offer and they can see their own fingerprints on it and their own reflection in that offer, they're going to be infinitely more likely to actually champion that offer to the seller, whom you may never actually get to speak with. Remember, we don't always often talk to the seller. Sometimes we can only go through this gatekeeper, the realtor. So you have to have the realtor not only turn in the offer, but recommend the offer. And so to get that buy-in, they've really got to understand how this works. And you're going to have to be able to explain it to them in detail. And again, why it's of value. That's absolute key. Why the seller needs to do this with you.
That's huge. So let's go into the two main creative financing techniques that you talk about in the book. One being seller financing and two being the master lease option. Let's maybe start with seller financing.
Sure.
And talk about that, and we'll get to the master lease option afterwards. So maybe just share a few examples on when does it make sense for a seller to consider seller financing for their best interest?
I'm sorry. Yeah, a seller cannot give seller financing if they have a mortgage in place. And that's sort of the big catch with seller financing. The seller has to have full equity or at least any down payment money that you're bringing to the seller would have to be enough to clear out any debt they may have, you know, on there. So a seller cannot give interest they do not have. So they can't lend you a property that they've borrowed against. It's not how that works. So
what percentage deals fall into that category? I mean, that's a big barrier to get by. So again, I'm thinking that might be the smaller deals versus the larger deals.
Yes, smaller deals typically. Your larger deals, you're more inclined to get a percentage carry back than 100% financing. So in your smaller deals, you may get full seller financing. You bring 10, 20% down, something of that nature, and the seller does have the equity. That's going to be typically what we call your mom and pop deals, where that is an owner that has owned the building for a long time, 10, 20 years, and they've paid that asset down. And now they're looking to retire. They're looking to get out of the place, something else. And seller financing is a great way for a seller who has a tremendous amount of equity to accomplish two things. One, mitigate taxes. You know, they're not going to take a tax hit on that lump sum of cash in the sale. Number one, the capital gains. Number two, it allows them to continue sort of an annuity, a payment every single month. Maybe they enjoyed getting cash flow from this property and they really like that revenue stream. Seller financing is a way to allow that seller to continue collecting a monthly payment. So that's who we're looking for. Smaller percentage of the time, you're going to find that. Larger assets, you're probably getting assistance with the down payment. You may be getting a seller carry back. Now you have to get permission of the primary debt to allow that. So it's not just about negotiating that with the seller. You do have to get permission from the bank. Number one. Number two, not 100%. And this is a question I get a lot of times. Well, hey, can't I just borrow 80% from the bank and then have the seller carry back 20% and I'm in the deal with no money down? Not going to occur. No regular lender is going to allow you to have zero at-risk capital. And that's a fancy way of saying skin in the game. That's the technical term. So I have never seen more than 10% carry back.
10%. Okay.
Yeah, 10% is your average for a carry back. So it is still seller financing. It's just not 100%. Self-finance. And I've done 100% up to 10% and everything in between.
Let's go down that path that we did before where I asked you the process and you would talk to a broker. Let's do that same thing on the seller financing. So, you know, I'm a 90-year-old guy. I've had a property for, 40 years. It's totally paid off. I'm clipping a good cash flow, but I'm sick of managing it. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm just going to sell it and go retire someplace. Now you come along and you discuss it with the broker and you present something different. How do you change my mindset?
Yeah, first thing you want to address right out of the gate is the elephant in the room. And I mean, almost kind of make a joke about it. Hey, listen, I know you want your commission. Don't worry. We're going to get you paid. You know, just put them at ease right out of the gate because that is going to be their number one pushback. And I guarantee you that realtor's not listening until they think they're getting paid. So just hit that right on up front.
So how does the broker get paid?
Right. How do they get paid? Right. Yeah. How are we going to get them their commission? There's lots of different ways. Okay. I have shared in cash flow. So number one, basic answer is you are probably going to pay out their commission when you exit the deal. So when you refinance or you sell that asset, something like that, it's going to be sort of an IOU. But in the meantime, what you want to do is either have an equity share or a cash flow share with that realtor. You know, and you can do there's no rules. You can do anything from give them an IOU, again, a chunk of the general partnership, limited partnership. You can give them cash flow. You can go cut their grass every Saturday. I mean, it doesn't matter. The creativity is on your side, but you must guarantee that they will get that commission. Number two, bring that commission into the actual document. And I'm going to basically say the same thing when we discuss lease options. You always want to show the realtor that their commission is a part of the legal document that will be filed against this property and cloud the title with this legal document. So even if you and the realtor are good people, and for some reason the seller turns out to be a bad person and decides to try and do something sneaky, sell the property again to some other buyer without you knowing it, or go to Mexico with the money or whatever the case, you're going to have that title clouded with this document, and in there protects the realtor. So that's one thing I addressed right on out of the gate. We're going to get you paid and we're going to make sure you're safe. How am I going to do that? I'm going to put you into the document and we're going to have a legal closing. Now, you never want to do these kind of contracts on the hood of your car. You know, you must go through a legal closing with an attorney, with a title company, so that all documents are recorded and everyone is protected. So don't ever do this like, you know, outside of without legal counsel. That's how everyone here stays protected.
So I'm the broker and I've got your offer with this IOU and I've got another offer. And I'm still thinking to myself, I want to take this other one and get paid next month when we close.
And you should do it. Go ahead.
So
and when it does close, call me back.
There you go. So
it's and when that loan fails, call me back.
Because I'll be right. Their structure isn't going to work. They're not going to be able to get the lender that they're saying that they can get.
Fine. Never browbeat a seller. Never browbeat a realtor. Never strong arm someone. That's not a good technique. You're only going to burn relationships that way. Make the offer. Show the value. Show the realtor the value you bring. And if it's not you they choose to go with, and if it's not your offer, then fine. Confidence sells. Let that realtor know you got a ton of other deals you're working on. If this seller is not interested in having you solve their problems, not a problem. There's a lot of other sellers you're going to bring value to, and you're going on down the street to work with them. By the way, here's my offer. Here's my letter of intent. You know, hey, if anything happens in the future, you know, unfortunately, if that deal doesn't go through, which I sure hope it does, and I sure hope you all make a lot of money, but if for some reason something goes wrong, here's my name, number, give me a call. Love to hear from you. Never burn the bridge. I have really had a lot of deals come back to me after a hard no, after almost even being laughed at. You know, a realtor thinks, you know, they've sunshine's coming out of their rear end, right? And they're the bee's knees, if you will. And they're telling me, hey, you know, who are you with this kind of offer? And man, they come back hat in hand, eating some humble pie when that big hotshot offer that seemed like a great offer doesn't close. And that's sure. What we're going to see a lot more of going forward is people making offers they can't back up. Right. Amateur realtors and amateur sellers are very quick to grab a purchase price without really vetting a buyer, without really vetting this offer to see, can this buyer really close this high flying number they just threw out? The answer turns out to be no. And then that buyer's over there retrading the deal. That's where you get a phone call.
Gotcha.
And don't be cocky about it. Don't ever rub anything in anybody's face.
Right. So on this, the other point on that, you talked about mitigating taxes. So I'm that, you know, 90-year-old guy, and I'm thinking I'm going to have to sell the property and pay my, you know, I'm in a low basis. I'm going to have to sell and pay my capital gain and move on. But all of a sudden you present an opportunity that gives me a lot of what I want. It gives me continued cash flow, but I'm not having to take the big capital gain tax right off the get-go.
Correct.
With the seller financing.
Right. You're only going to pay taxes on profit. And that profit is going to come in monthly increments. So you're not going to have that gigantic lump sum sucking sound of all your capital walking out towards Uncle Sam. Yeah. And that's very attractive to a lot of sellers.
All right. So let's move on to master lease options. This is one that, and look, I've never done seller financing or master lease option, but just the thought of master lease option sounds a lot more complicated. And, you know, but it's like anything. Once you do it, right, and you understand it, you gain confidence, and then you have another tool to offer, you know, to solve a problem. So talk about how that works.
Absolutely. And I'm, right before we get into that, I do want to reiterate a point that you've made a couple of times. Yeah. These are tools.
Right.
These are not the only tools. Creative financing is about increasing probability, not possibility, probability, right? That's all we're trying to do. You know, I have found through my career and through education that you will close about 1 in 80 deals that you analyze. That's what I call the race to 80. So you are always trying to get to the 80th deal analyzed because that's your probability that you'll find the one to close. Well, that's kind of taking an approach at buying real estate by saying, okay, here's a deal. We'll go to the bank. We'll get a loan. We'll put down 20%. So with creative financing, we're going to add a few more tools to the toolbox that will increase probability. Maybe we can do 3 out of 80 or 4 out of 80 now. The reason that I'm bringing this up is I don't want people walking around thinking, oh, I'm going to only do lease options. Oh, I'm going to only do seller financing. That is a terrible point of view. You're here to do real estate in any manner that it can be done. By the way, if you can borrow money and put down 20% and get the deal done, you should do that. You should do that. If the deal doesn't work, instead of throwing it in the trash and saying, hold on, let's look at it through a new lens of creative financing and see if any of these techniques make any difference. But they are not the only techniques. So very important, as you mentioned, Aaron, there are tools in the toolbox.
Yeah, that's a great point. With even in today's market and before it turns, like there are some deals that, you know, occupancy is below 90%. Well, correct. The agencies won't look at that deal. Right.
Cool.
So now if you're a buyer and you just want agency financing, then you just end up throwing that deal out, where now here's a couple of opportunities to look at it from a different lens.
Correct. But not the only lens. And neither is going to the bank the only way. And that's why I want people to broaden their spectrum here of how they look at real estate and to come at it from a creative problem solving point of view. And then all of a sudden, a lot of different opportunities present themselves that you were not cognizant of before. Now they're deals where before they were not deals because you were just going at it with the one technique. It's like they say, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, we want to have some other tools. You're not just bashing everything with that same hammer. That's not a good way to try and do real estate. Or you will only do deals in very certain parameters and very certain types of deals. Right. And right now, deals are hard to come by. The market's pretty heated, and so we need as many techniques to broaden and cast as wide a net as absolutely possible.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You also talked about something in the book called SPY, which talking about, you know, being a problem solver. Talk about that acronym, because I thought that was interesting. It kind of changed the focus.
Yeah, that is an acronym I created after really watching a lot of my students, some becoming very successful with creative financing and some failing completely with creative financing. And so I really made a case study between the two groups that succeeded and failed with my techniques. And I said, why are some making it and some aren't? And what I found was it is the offer process that was knocking the ones out that weren't being successful. And most people, like those students, were looking at deals from the you, me, what's good for me, then what's wrong with the property. Oh, yeah, there's a seller involved. And as I said, 90% of a good deal is seller, 10% is the real estate. And so they were making offers that only solved their personal problems. Maybe it solved the property's problems and almost completely ignored the seller. And so that's when I developed this technique going, okay, we've got to reverse that. And that's why I created the SPY technique, seller, property, you. That's the order in which you want to do a deal analysis. And that's the order in which you want to create an offer that solves problems. Solve the seller's problems, then look at the property, solve the property's problems. And lastly, because you are the least important aspect of the deal, solve your own problems.
Right. Everybody wants to focus on themselves. So
too bad. How you get creative financing.
Right. Exactly.
If you've got
all
the money you need, then you can focus on yourself. If you're trying to create wealth with someone else's money, you better focus on them first.
Absolutely. The same holds true when you're doing these syndicated deals and you're raising capital from investors, a lot of people may focus on how great the deal is instead of kind of focusing on why this is a good opportunity for you as a passive investor.
And, absolutely. And I've even had syndicated deals. When limited partners are investing in a deal, I'm still going to tell you they're investing 90% in you. 10% because of the real estate. And I think that's something most syndicators completely forget. Now, we're talking creative financing here, but I have traditionally syndicated many deals. So, I've done all types of financing, not just creative financing. And at all of the money that I've raised, all the deals that I've done traditional syndications on, I've had maybe a handful of investors actually come look at the property. even show up and look at the asset that they just wrote a $500,000 check for. Very, very few people show up. It's the relationship they had with me. It's the person, not the building. So you really have to focus on who you are as a person, as a business person, as a character. That's more important than the deal or the numbers, the cash flow, or any of that stuff.
And I mean, your track record, right? So they trust the fact that you're going to make them money.
Sure.
Hey, so I cut you off before. I asked you to describe what master lease option was, and then we went into a different tangent. So if we could go back to that,
sure.
Just describe what that actually is and how that works.
Yeah, so a master lease option is actually two separate documents, two separate contracts that collectively make our master lease option. The two separate contracts are a master lease and an option to purchase. So sort of generally what this is a rent-to-own type model. If we were dealing with houses, this would be what we would call a lease option. We use the term master lease option when we're talking about multiple units. So it's really functionally the same concept. Master just means, you know, more than one. All right. So the master lease allows us to go in and rent an apartment complex. The option to purchase is where we set the purchase price today and how long I have to actually buy the property for that price. Quick example. Let's say, Darren, you have a deal. You're a burned out landlord. I come in and say, hey, let's do a master lease option. Okay. My master lease allows me to rent the property from you with the right to sublet those units, meaning I'm just going to turn around and release the property back out to the tenants who are already there. Okay. That allows me to control the management, the operations, and the cash flow. The idea is that you find some kind of property that is not financeable that could be turned around if you maybe just brought a little bit of money or a little bit of effort or a little bit of energy or a better management company or these sorts of things. Then Darren, you and I are going to set a price for this property. And so we'll say you're going to sell me this asset for $1 million. Okay, fine. How long do I have to buy this asset for $1 million? And you and I would agree on a time frame. Let's say it's 2 years, you know, and so you'd say, okay, Bill, you have 2 years in which to buy this asset for $1 million. And if you don't buy it in that amount of time, you're in default of this agreement. What is the remedy if you're in default? You put down what we call option money, which is about the same thing as earnest money deposit. You're going to put up a deposit. If you purchase or exercise the option to purchase, that deposit is applied to the purchase price, just like a normal earnest money deposit. And if you don't close the option, if I don't close the option in this scenario, within that 12 or 24 months, then I'm going to default and walk away from the deal, but you're going to keep the deposit money. So idea is that you find something that you can negotiate that option price on and force the value through the operations and through that master lease. You're forcing the value beyond the option price. So in this scenario, you know, our deal we have here is $1 million. Hopefully over that 2 year window, the market gets better, and through my efforts on the property, I've increased the value. Now maybe it's worth $2 million, okay? A lease, a master lease.
I'm like, I don't want to sell it to you for $1 million anymore.
That is a risk. That is actually a very real risk, and that occurs. So what I recommend, since you brought that up, is to cash flow back all of the earnest money within one half of the time of the total option. All right, let me explain that. So if you said to me, okay, Bill, I'll give you 2 years in which to buy this property. What I would do is sit down and analyze your deal and say, how much do I believe I can produce in cash flow in 12 months? Because that's half of our 2 year window here. I would not put up more option money than that. Why? Because if we get to the end of 2 years and one of two things happens, I decide I don't want to buy your property. Maybe I found something wrong with it. Maybe, you know, after test driving this thing, I figured out it was a lemon and I don't really want to own it. I'm going to walk away. You're going to keep my option money, my deposit. So what? I cash flowed it all back already. I have no risk. You just turn out to be a bad person and you say, you know what, Bill, sue me. I don't want to trade I don't want to give you the property. You made it worth $10 million and we agreed on $1 million, you know, and I'm just not going to give it to you. Now, at least you have the decision to decide whether you want to address that legally or not. But if for some reason I just decided to say, well, you're a bad person and I'm just going to let, you know, karma take care of that, at least I wouldn't have any more capital and I would not be, you know, injured financially in that scenario. So sure. That's why I kind of use that formula of analyze the deal. It's half the option window's worth of cash flow. That's also a way of kind of creating a time frame for option. You can reverse the math. Hey, how long should you and I do this option agreement for? Well, I don't know. Let me see how much it cash flows in a year. You know, what are you willing to go? And so that's a way that you can kind of decide either time frame or how much money to put down as the option.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Hey, you told a funny story in the book. Something like somebody called you an idiot.
Yeah, so, my very first mentor, actually.
Really? Is it right? Is that right?
Mentor, yeah.
So tell that story. I thought that was funny. So, that was,
I had bought a duplex. My very first deal was a duplex. And I was a pilot by trade. Had been flying airplanes for some years, working. And I realized that the important people were actually sitting behind me in the airplane. You know, a pilot was like really important from takeoff to landing, completely worthless on the ground. I didn't know that when I was like going out for flight academy, you know. And so I wound up spending hours and hours sitting around in hotels and airports waiting to just be a chauffeur. And I got tired of it. And so I spent about a year studying real estate. My very first deal was a duplex. I got seller financing. Put a little money down, man, I'm a genius. You know, I'm all high and excited. And I go to my very first REIA group meeting, and that's a real estate investment association, REIA group, for those you don't know. And it's a local club and it's full of all the local investors, you know, and I come in, I'm kind of nervous. I'm the new guy to the group. I was 28 years old at the time, you know, so younger person. And I come in, of course, as these groups do, they kind of go around the room and say, okay, who's done any deals? You know, who's done their business? Who's done their first deal? And of course, me, I did a deal, you know, and they said, oh, great, Bill, you know, round of applause for this guy and this kind of garbage. And they said, well, tell us about your deal. You know, and I said, okay, great. It was a duplex and, you know, it cash flows $300 a month and I paid $43,000. And right when I said the price, there was a guy in the back of the room just busted out laughing. Okay, now I'm like, what? And the guy goes, you're an idiot. Oh my God. So I turned around and I just said, the only thing that came to my mind, I said, want to go to lunch? and so I did. I took the guy to lunch and I said, look, you know, what did I do wrong? Tell me, you know, I was able to check my ego because I was willing to learn. If I'd made a mistake, I just want to know. I was just hungry for information.
Right.
And the guy says, look, man, you're a moron. He said, you paid $43,000 a door or $43,000 for this duplex. He goes, everybody else in the neighborhood paid $20,000.
Oh,
whoops. I overpaid by more than a 2x margin. The lesson there, well, there's lots of lessons. One, hey, when somebody tells you you're stupid, check your ego. You might want to, they might have something to tell you.
Right.
Before you get mad, go find out what they have to say. You can get mad at them later, but in the beginning, there might be a lesson in there, you know? And so that's what I did. I took him to lunch. We talked, and in the ultimate mistake that I made was I analyzed the deal through a narrow window of cash flow. I analyzed the deal from the income approach only, and I did not take the deal and put it into context of the rest of the market. So I kind of did the old rich dad, poor dad, you know, it cash flows, it makes money. And I followed the formula and that part worked. Oh yeah, they forgot to talk about appraisals. They forgot to talk about comparable sales. They forgot to talk about, you know, back up and look at what everybody else is paying. And so I just kind of followed that very basic advice that I got out of that book. And it just said, hey, if it cash flows, what a good deal. Terrible advice. And I overpaid by a little more than 2x. And yes, that was a good lesson.
Actually,
still a friend of mine. As a matter of fact, it's funny. I was at a boot camp this last weekend and somebody came up and they said the same thing. They said, oh, that was a funny story. That was my favorite part of the book. And it reminded me to text my friend. And I said, hey, go get a copy of my book. You know, I wrote you in there. And I said, you remember the first thing you said to me? I said, you told me I was an idiot. And he replied right back was, yeah, did you tell him you immediately told me to go to lunch with you? I said, yeah, that was in the book. So guy's still a very good friend of mine. I've known him for 16 years. He's in my phone right now.
That's great.
And was one of my first mentors. Bit of a jerk, but he was one of my mentors. And you know what? He was honest and he was right.
Yeah.
And I was really, really, really thankful that someone had the nerve to stand up and at least tell me I was wrong.
Absolutely.
And in whatever manner they were going to tell me. So.
But you know what? Had you not taken action, had you not purchased the duplex, you wouldn't have gone to the RIA. You wouldn't have raised your hand. You wouldn't have told the story. You wouldn't have met the guy. And, you know, so all those things, you know.
My philosophy now from that is, hey, look, if you screw up one, buy two. If you screw up two, buy 10. You'll get it right eventually. Just stop. You know, if you make a mistake, cost average the mistake.
Right.
It's when you make a mistake and you stop. That's when that mistake just becomes set in stone. And I have had some really hard times in my business. I have had some very, very financial difficult times. I've had trouble paying my light bill. I've had credit cards I couldn't pay. You know, I've had very financial issues in building my business. It was not all success from day one and up and riches. I went through some very hard times back in the recession and learning to build my business. And I forgot where I was going with that. But anyway, so yeah, you really got to learn to kind of deal with some of that stuff and check your ego.
And appreciate the guy that, you know, stepped up and said that, and you took him out to lunch and he shared info with you. You know, it reminds me of a story. When I joined the multifamily mentorship group, I'm at one of the happy hours, and you know, I was kind of naive, and I'm like, we're having beers. I'm like, hey, I'm a nice guy. Like, hey, let's partner together, you know? And a few people just kind of like, you know, kind of laughed and just say, yeah, maybe. But then I had one person that said, Darren, you know, if I find a deal, why am I going to partner with you? I'm going to partner with the guy over there that's done 5 deals, that has a huge database to call. Like, what value would you bring me?
That's
and I was it. Like, I was like, holy cow, like that opened my eyes. And I was like, well, why would you want to partner with somebody like me that's new? And the person said, go find the deal. You find the deal and do all the work and then come to me and I'm the experienced person. Well, now you've brought value. And I'm like, holy cow, that person being honest with me, although I would have liked them to just say, yeah, I'll partner with you and like bring me a deal and it was easy. And that person being honest with me early on changed my focus to, hey, now I know what I got to do. I need to go out and find the deal. I got to build relationships with these people so I know who to call when I get the deal. But I got to go out and that's the value I bring.
I've had that exact same conversation with people. And I have had an early person have that exact same conversation with me. And they were a lot less polite about it than you just slapped around a little bit. But, you know, it was a same takeaway that you had. It was rough. It hurt my feelings at the moment. And then I was super thrilled that individual set me straight because he actually set me straight. And then I was on a path of realizing you can't partner with someone where you don't bring value.
Right.
You know, and you don't get into deals where you don't bring value. That's not a good idea. And so the advice I would give here and that I do give most people and that individual gave me was I will not partner for something I can outsource to an employee. You know, so when people come to me now and they say, hey, Bill, love you, mean it, man, I'll carry your luggage. I'll take out the trash. You know, I'll do all your underwriting, whatever you need me to do. I can go on, get a VA. I can go on Fiverr and get that taken care of. I would never forfeit equity for something that can be outsourced to an employee. So you're going to have to bring value to me that is irreplaceable. And exactly what that individual told you, find a deal. Right. That's what my book is about. It's about getting results in finding deals.
That's huge. That's huge. You know, I think that what's your take when the market goes? So over the last, this wasn't really planned, but, you know, the syndication field has really grown the last 3, 4, 5 years. I just got involved 3 years ago. And since I've gotten involved, I've just seen a ton of new people come in. And what do you think happens when we do go into, you know, a downturn? Does it thin out?
It does. Yeah. So, you know, and I'll try and be as positive as I can, but there are a lot of people that don't make it. Two things. When we go into a recession, I hope you have a good building that's not in terrible shape, because that's where you're going to have trouble. If you're in an older building, and I recommend a lot of my students avoid older buildings right now, because the hold time may be longer for you to be able to reach that exit strategy. And some of these buildings are getting really old, and they may not have the longevity as far as capital expenses are concerned. So number one, I hope you have a building that's in pretty decent shape. I hope you don't have debt that comes due anytime soon. And I hope you're a good operator. This is the cycle of the operator, not the speculator. The speculator does well on the upside. It's the downside that burns away all the fair weather operators in this business. And true techniques are only passed on by those of us who have survived. Everyone else washed away.
That's a good point. And I hear that from a lot of syndicators that are very experienced, saying that the next 5-10 years are going to be operations focused. So
correct.
What's the next big stretch goal for you? I mean, look, is this your first book?
It is my first book.
And as a matter of fact,
it is.
How was it putting out your first book? I mean,
it was interesting. It was really fun, actually. It was a great experience.
Awesome.
Working with Gino at Weirboro Profits. They helped me publish the book, and they really sort of spearheaded that. And I partnered with them. So it was a great partnership on the book. And I'm actually about 60% of the way through a second book.
Are you really?
Turns out I'm a writer. Turns out I'm good at it, and I actually enjoy it. I wrote every single sentence in that book. That's a question I've been asked a lot over the last couple of weeks. It's like, how does writing a book work? You just kind of make an outline,
yeah,
and then you turn it into a publisher, and then they write the book for you. Yeah, you might can do that. I did not. That is every single sentence in that book is my blood, sweat, and tears.
Good for you.
Edit it, but I wrote it, every bit of it. And I'm now about 60% of the way through a second book. And so that will be called Real Estate Raw. And that'll be out maybe in a few more months. We'll see.
That's awesome. Well, you know what? I mean, look, it's a big step to get a book out. And then what you're doing seems to happen. Like, you want, once somebody writes one, all of a sudden they realize they can do it. It's like anything in life, man. It's like, if you... There's all these unknowns as to what you have to do to make it happen. Real estate investing is one of them. Writing a book is another. And then once you do it, you kind of understand it and you can replicate that.
Well, as I always said, you have to have a bike in order to learn how to ride a bike.
Yes.
Just go get a bike and start pedaling. Are you going to fall off and scrape your knees? Yeah, probably so. But you know, if you never get on that thing and start pedaling, you're never going to learn to ride it. Just take action. You know, I think our brains are really only for 20% thinking, 80% action. You know, my mind is really just from keeping me from doing really dumb stuff and falling in holes in the road. Otherwise, I'm mostly action focused and thought second. You know, you really got to get out there. The world is not as difficult as people tend to think that it is. I think people harbor a lot of unnecessary anxiety about how bad things are, or how negatively someone might think of them, or what their appearance is, and these sorts of things. And the world is just not as difficult as you think. Just take action and go find out.
Awesome. So what's your next big stretch goal, other than writing your second book?
Yeah, writing the second book. Finding a good deal would be a good one. That's a bit of a tough one these days.
Right.
Moving into doing a lot of the education. You know, I am a disciplined purchaser. I look at deals every single week, several a week. I am not passive, and I'm not sitting on the sidelines waiting for the market to shift, but I don't change my parameters to match the market. I know what a good deal is, and I'm only going to buy a good deal, and I don't care what the market's doing. If it's not a good deal, I'm not going to purchase it, and I'm not going to put my investors' money in harm's way unless I truly feel that's a good deal. So I'm just not getting offers accepted because of the pricing. It's not that I'm inactive.
Right.
You know, we are. I'm just staying very disciplined. And I see that lack of discipline in a lot of new syndicators. You know, they're really starting to what I call pencil whip deals. They're really starting to pencil whip a lot of these things, meaning just making it look good on a piece of paper. But in reality, in that operational cycle, I really question whether a lot of those deals are actually going to perform as they were meant to on paper. And that's what the experienced people will tell you. We're going into an operator cycle, and that's where the curtain is going to get pulled back on people who were overly aggressive in their underwriting techniques.
Right. What do you do for fun outside of real estate?
Oh, let's see. I like to garden. That's probably my first answer. I'm a big gardener, plant person. I'm always growing flowers.
It's funny because Jake said that he likes to, I don't know if he said gardening, but like he likes to work on the outside of the house.
He's planting a lot of flowers and does a lot of landscaping stuff around his house. He has a home that they've only been in recently. I think he's kind of in that phase of getting his dream home right the way he likes it. Gotcha. And me, I'm just, I see it's not about green thumbs. It's about brown knees, right? So I'm just constantly in the dirt. Love playing in the dirt. I'm a big kid. I love digging, planting, doing things of that nature. I like water sports. So avid water skier. I've been skiing since I was young and a very avid water skier. So
where do you live?
I live in Atlanta.
Atlanta, okay.
Yep. And we have a property up in the North Georgia Mountains on a lake called Lake Raven, a beautiful place up in the North Georgia Mountains. And so my family has had a property on that lake for four generations, almost 90 years now.
Oh, wow.
We've many generations of water skiers learned to ski in the North Georgia Mountains of all places.
I love the lake. The lake, good time. Yeah. So, hey, if people want to, first, how do they find your book? And where can they buy your book and in what format can they buy the book? And then secondly, if somebody wants to reach out to you personally, you know, how do they do that?
Yeah, the book actually is on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible. So you can get it in all three formats. I actually did the voice recording for Audible. So it was read and written by Bill Ham.
Did you really? That's another skill you have to learn.
That was interesting. I have never read a book out loud. That was different. I have tremendous respect for these people who are narrators professionally on Audible. Man, that was not easy. And it's highly edited, so you'll be safe in that. I'm good at reading out loud, but I stumble over a lot of the word, even my own book. And so we were able to edit all that out. So I hope it sounds pretty good. But
that's great.
Yeah, so you can get it on Audible, Kindle, excuse me, and Amazon.
Okay.
And if you want to, we also have the book and a masterclass. So I have a little more information if you want higher level training at creativeapartmentdeals.com. You can go there and get the book and the masterclass. You can also reach out to me at broadwellpropertygroup.com. That's our home website. That's our company. Broadwell Property Group. We have a spot there for investors. If anyone is interested in maybe doing some business with us, you can go in there and put your information, and our CEO, Tony Morgan, will reach out to you directly. And my email directly is bill@gobroadwell. So reach out to me, send me an email at bill@gobroadwell. If you have any questions, love to answer them.
Listeners, the book name is Creative Cash. There will come a time where financing will shift and we will all need to learn these skills. So I hope you enjoyed that one. Until next week, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.